In the previous lecture, I described the difference between legitimate, rigorous science and science that is so fatally flawed it should be considered fake science or pseudoscience. In this lecture, I'm going to give several specific examples of pseudosciences and then deconstruct them in detail to illustrate some of the various features of pseudoscience. First up is iridology. This is a practice that was invented in 1800 by Ignaz von Pezeli. He based his entire belief of iridology on a single observation. He accidentally broke an owl's leg, the story goes, and noticed a black stripe in its iris, the iris of its eye. When the owl's leg later healed, that black speck went away. He concluded from this that the iris of the eye reflects the health and illness of a living organism, an owl or a person. In fact, the iris is a map of the entire body, where the flecks and color reflect the state of health or illness of each different part of the body. This belief follows a more general belief known as a homunculus or a homunculus paradigm, this notion that the entire body is mapped in some way to a smaller subset of the body. In this case, there is a map of the entire body, including all the internal organs in the iris of the eye. Another example of this might be reflexology, where there is a health and illness map of the organs of the body and the different body parts on the sole of the feet. Then in such systems, it is believed that either you can diagnose illness simply by looking at a small part of the body, or that you can actually affect health and illness. You can improve the health of a part of the body by massaging the foot, or in auricular acupuncture, sticking a needle into a part of the ear. There is, however, no scientific basis for this whatsoever. There is no chain of research. There are no independent lines of evidence. There's no underlying anatomy that shows how one part of the body maps to or connects all the other parts of the body in this way. Or there's no underlying anatomical structure that could explain how the kidney, for example, could affect one tiny piece of the iris. What iridologists do is essentially what we would call a medical cold reading. Remember, a cold reading is making vague and common guesses about someone, in this case, their symptoms, and then using that give and take to hone in and to give the impression that you have detailed knowledge about their symptoms, when in fact you're just using guesses and feedback in order to create the illusion that you have knowledge about their symptoms. They also use methods that cold readers use in order to compensate, for example, for guessing wrong. If you ask someone, for example, well, do you have any lung disease based upon your reading of their iris, and they say that they don't, you could say, well, you have a susceptibility for lung disease, so this is something that might become a problem in the future. And that way they turn a miss into a hit and give the impression, the false impression, that they have some knowledge about their health. There have, surprisingly, been scientific studies looking at the accuracy of iridology, of practitioners of iridology, in diagnosing health and illness in individuals. A 2000 review by Edzard Ernst of studies that were deemed to be of sufficient quality concluded that iridologists perform no better than chance when they are properly blinded. In essence, they were getting no information from looking at the iris in the eye of the subjects that they were attempting to diagnose. That's significant evidence that there is no underlying reality to iridology whatsoever. However, the practice of iridology persists as a so-called alternative practice. Current practitioners engage in special pleading, which you'll remember from the logical fallacy lectures. For example, here is a quote from an iridology website explaining what iridology can and cannot do. It reads, "Iridology will not show or name a specific disease, but provides information about the body tissues which indicate tendencies towards condition of disease, often before symptoms appear. Iridology will not reveal surgery performed under anesthesia as nerve impulses are discontinued. Iridology cannot locate parasites, gallstones, or germ life, but will indicate the presence of inflammation and toxic conditions which are a refuge for their development. It will not show pregnancy as that is a normal function of the female body. In other words, iridology will not reveal anything that is testable, anything objective that could prove whether or not iridology works. It can only show vague tendencies that cannot be specifically tested. So the believers in iridology have successfully insulated or isolated their claims from the scientific evidence, which shows that it in fact provides no information. Let's turn now to ghost hunting. This is a fun example of a pseudoscience. Have you, for example, ever had an unusual experience? Perhaps you have woken up in the morning paralyzed, unable to move, maybe even sense that there is a presence in the room with you. Some people report feeling a heaviness on their chest, might even feel panic at the helplessness of their situation. Are these experiences evidence of encounters with demons or spirits, or perhaps aliens, as some interpret them? We'll get back to that in a moment, but first let's talk about the science behind ghost hunting. In this talk, I'm not going to be talking about what people believe, but in what the scientific evidence shows. People may have belief in spirits or ghosts, and that's okay, but is there scientific evidence that they exist? And what are the so-called ghost hunters doing who claim to be scientifically investigating ghosts as a phenomenon? Do they have the evidence that they claim to have? Ghost hunting science shows recently have been very popular on reality TV, for example. Therefore, many people are exposed to the practices of ghost hunting, and it is presented as if it is a science. I have personally investigated a number of ghost hunting groups and a few allegedly haunted houses. I think it is an excellent example of pseudoscience. Ghost hunters go through the motions of doing science, but they don't engage in the true nature of scientific inquiry. Let's turn, for example, to the types of evidence that they present that ghosts are a real phenomenon, the most common of which is ghost photographs. They often present what are called orbs, which are circles of light on photographic film, or ghost globules, sometimes streaks or coils. At times, more interesting photos appear to have ghostly figures or people on the picture. This is all a good example of anomaly hunting. Ghost hunters look for anything unusual and then conclude that it is evidence of something specific, ghosts. They therefore make the argument from ignorance in doing so. They may take the time to dismiss a token alternative or two, but they do not engage in the true practice of science, which is hypothesis testing, a controlled experiment in order to distinguish one cause for the alleged anomaly versus something else. For example, are the things that appear on photographs that I've been describing, globules and streaks, are they photographic artifacts? An artifact of the process of taking or perhaps developing the picture? Or are they a picture of something real in the outside world? And they have no gold standard or basis for what a ghost photograph should look like with a basic science understanding of what that should be. And so they can declare any anomaly a ghost. There are, however, explanations for the photographs that are presented by ghost hunters. For example, you may notice that most photos with light effects use a flash. One ghost hunting website, in fact, advised people to use a flash because you get a lot more ghost photographs when you do that. Orbs are a known photographic artifact of the lens. It's a lens flare or some other lens reflective or refractive artifact. Sometimes light can reflect off of dust motes, things that you won't see with the naked eye, but the camera will pick it up when a flash reflects off of the dust mote. Streaks are often the result of the so-called camera cord effect, which could be due to anything that's in front of the lens and very close, especially when a flash is used. Even a black plastic camera cord, when in front of the lens, will reflect the light and cause a white streak across the film. Or they may be due to unfamiliar settings on digital cameras. I recently investigated a photograph that turned out to be the twilight mode. This is a new setting on digital cameras that uses a flash, but then keeps the shutter open in order to expose more distant or dark areas of the field that would not have been illuminated by the flash, such as taking a picture at twilight. This, however, creates the potential for camera movements to cause streaks of light across the picture, resulting in strange effects that you may not be able to imagine how they got there if you're not familiar with the operation of the twilight mode. Other photographic effects might include an actual image of a ghostly person or figure in the film or on the picture. This is not a streak or a globule, so this can't be a simple artifact. There's got to be something else going on. Older cameras often created accidental double exposures. If the film did not advance and a subsequent picture was taken, there could be a ghostly faint image of a person from one exposure on the other. Sometimes the ghostly image is just pareidolia. It is a fog effect, either because of literal smoke or fog in the environment, or just a overexposure from using a flash too closely creates this blurry image. And pareidolia, the tendency to, like, for example, see a face in a cloud, to impose a pattern on random stimuli, may allow you to see what appears to be a distorted ghostly body or face in the fog or in the image. Or it's possible that a real live person was simply in the field of view but wasn't noticed at the time that the picture was taken. Perhaps they were just walking through in the background, or a person was in a window and their face appears in the window in the background in the photograph. Ghost hunters also use scientific instruments to take readings and then declare any apparently anomalous readings as further evidence for ghosts. For example, they are fond of using electromagnetic detectors to look for electromagnetic or EM fields. Typically, they're using off-the-shelf EM detectors. Most of the ones that they use are not directional. Experts use EM detectors that are directional. They want to know what direction an electromagnetic field is coming from. But a lot of the ones that are used by ghost hunters are omnidirectional EM detectors. This means they could detect fields coming from any location and can't really be used, therefore, to conclude that an EM field is coming from one specific direction. They also don't control for the range of these EM detectors or the frequencies. They tend to use whatever frequency and distance range was available on the off-the-shelf EM detectors without any particular underlying scientific reason why that frequency would be the one that correlates with ghost activity, for example. But more importantly, in our modern society, electromagnetic fields are everywhere. You could find them in every house. Even if there is no electricity, just a concentration of iron, for example, can produce an EM field. The ghost hunters, however, do no controlled studies which are designed to determine what the source of the EM fields are and to rule out mundane explanations. Another phenomenon often presented by ghost hunters as evidence for ghost activity is so-called ghost cold. Cold spots that are alleged to be the evidence of a ghostly presence. Calling it ghost cold, however, doesn't make it evidence for ghosts. It is, in fact, just a cold spot in a house. Many houses have drafts and cold spots, especially older houses, the kind that ghost hunters are fond of investigating. Despite the fact that no one has been able to produce any reliable, compelling evidence that ghosts are a real phenomenon, people do have many ghostly or just anomalous experiences. I'm, of course, not dismissing that people have these experiences. The question is how best to interpret them. There is ample evidence that these experiences result from errors in perception. We learned in a previous lecture how flawed our perception can be. Or from pattern recognition, hyperactive agency detection, or simple errors in memory. All of the types of errors that we discussed earlier in this course come into play. Often, ghost encounters occur under poor observing conditions. They may occur when people are sleep-deprived, up late at night. That's when ghosts come out, right? Or when anxiety or just expectation levels are very high. What about what I described earlier in this lecture, the experience of waking up paralyzed, feeling that there is a menacing entity in the room with you, maybe feeling a heaviness on your chest? This can be a very scary, very compelling experience. This is what we call, what neurologists call, hypnagogic hallucinations or hypnagogia. This is a known neurological phenomenon. It is a fusion of the sleep-wake cycle and an intrusion of dreams, of a dreamlike state into the waking state, producing hallucinations and this sense of being you're paralyzed essentially because when you're dreaming, your brain paralyzes your body so that you don't sleepwalk, you don't act out your dreams. And this sleep paralysis persists into this pseudo-waking state. This can be a very intense experience. I've had many patients with it, and they're often frightened by it, and they don't know how to interpret it. These episodes have been documented, in fact, in many cultures throughout history, often giving rise to specific mythological beliefs about creatures that visit people late at night, sit on their chest, and steal their energy and paralyze them. But now we know this to be a neurological phenomenon. However, it is still interpreted by many pseudoscientists as either a ghost or demon encounter, and sometimes in modern culture as an alien encounter. Let's turn to a completely different type of pseudoscience, free energy. Now, of course, it would be great if we could find a clean, renewable, cheap, abundant, and efficient source of energy. Our civilization would be greatly enhanced by this. Our civilization runs on energy. Right now, much of that is fossil fuel because fossil fuels are cheap and abundant and a very efficient store of energy, although it is not clean or renewable. The strong need and desire for cheap energy leads to a lot of free energy or energy pseudoscience. The most extreme versions are referred to as free energy because they promise not just abundant but limitless energy. A common version of this is a motor that generates more power than it consumes. These motors are called over-unity machines because they produce more energy than they consume. Usually, these are demonstrated on a small scale with the claim that they are able to scale up. However, but at small scales, it's easy to miss a small energy source and confuse that with anomalous or free energy production. Just a failure to account for a little bit of extra heat in the system or an extraneous source of a little bit of kinetic or mechanical energy may produce the false impression, the false calculation, that there is extra energy in the system. There is then the assumption that this can scale up without limit. Of course, when free energy proponents try to do that, that's when their claims fall flat because they're not generating limitless energy from nothing. Such devices ultimately never work. They don't scale up because they can't generate free energy. Often, however, there are deliberate scams. There are companies that claim to be on the verge of a breakthrough in clean energy or free energy machines, using these small-scale demonstrations in order to trick investors into sinking lots of money into their invention, which they say is about to break through. Of course, they keep running into one hurdle after the other and need just a few more tens of thousands of dollars to do the research to fix those technical problems. But of course, there are more than technical problems with these devices. There are serious underlying theoretical issues. Many of these devices use magnets. They neglect the fact that the magnets themselves are providing a finite source of energy to the process. You can get magnets to create so-called perpetual motion, although that motion is using up the energy in the magnets, and eventually that energy will wear down. This also gets to the fact that when you try to scale up, you run into serious problems, and you also run into problems when you try to use these motors, not just as a way of spinning a wheel indefinitely because of the magnetic energy, but actually using it as a source of energy. Try running your house on the electricity being generated by such a device. They never seem to be able to do that. The most significant scientific problem with the free energy claims is that they violate the laws of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics essentially states the conservation of energy. Energy can change form but cannot be created out of nothing. The second law of thermodynamics states that in any thermodynamic process, some energy will be lost to entropy. So you might say the first law says that you cannot get more energy out of a process than you put in. And the second law says that you can't even get that. You can't even get the energy you put in because some has to be lost to entropy. Let's move on now to psi phenomena or psychic abilities, the ability to read other people's minds. This is sometimes called extrasensory perception, or a more technical term that has been used recently, anomalous cognition. The very name contains the concept of an anomaly. Other forms of this include precognition, the ability to perceive things before they happen, or remote viewing, the ability to perceive things that are remote from your location. These various phenomena have been actively researched over the last century. However, the plausibility here is extremely low. That's a red flag. It doesn't mean that these phenomena do not exist. It just means that we need to be especially skeptical. We need to require a degree of evidence that is in proportion with the implausibility of these claims. But even if we put the plausibility issue aside, researchers have not been able to get off of the first step, showing convincingly that psi phenomena even exist. In the past, psi research has produced, in fact, some classic examples of pseudoscientific methods. Now, they have admittedly moved beyond these types of errors, although I still see them crop up from time to time. One such phenomenon is called psi missing. This is the notion that sometimes somebody with ESP may guess the incorrect answer more often than would be predicted by chance. They are wrong rather than correct more often than chance. Their psychic ability is keeping them away from the correct answer rather than turning them towards the correct answer. Another example is optional starting and stopping. This is the notion that, well, some individuals with ESP may require a warm-up period before their abilities kick in. And then their abilities may fatigue, they may wear out and stop working at some point. Both of these are excellent examples of inadvertent mining of the data, or cherry-picking the data, looking for and counting only those data points that are positive and eliminating the negative data points. Psi missing, for example, essentially doubles your chances that there will be a run of guesses that are statistically significant. So not only a positive run counts, but now a negative run also counts. Optional starting and stopping is simply a way of cherry-picking a random streak or run in the data that hits more often than chance by just the clumpiness of random data. It is nothing less than a way of picking out the hits and eliminating the misses from a random string of data. With both of these, you have to, however, look at all of the data and look at it all in a consistent statistical way in order to say if there is a real phenomenon happening. And when you do this, the research shows that there is no phenomenon. These are not extra streaks of missing or extra streaks of hitting in the middle of the data. When you look at all the data, it all averages out to no effect or to the null hypothesis. The psi missing and the optional starting and stopping comes from a flawed sense of probability. It ignores the fact, as we discussed in previous lectures, that in any random sequence, there will be runs of clumpiness, of chance hits and misses that will occur by chance alone. This is probably why this type of research has never been reproduced, meaning that psi research occasionally comes up with a type of experiment that the researchers claim shows a psi phenomenon. But when other scientists try to reproduce the results, they find that they can't. Any single study could be a misinterpretation, or it could be a statistical fluke. If you use a cutoff of a p-value of 0.05, for example, to use statistical jargon, what essentially that means is that 1 in 20 studies with that cutoff will show a statistically significant effect even when there is no phenomenon at all. These are so-called statistical false positives. So essentially, there is, if we mine the studies themselves for the positive ones, and there is a name for that called publication bias, when you are only motivated to publish those studies which show something interesting, a positive result, then we will create the false impression that there are studies which show a psi phenomenon. However, if it was just a random fluctuation, a clumpiness of the data, then we would expect that the same pattern won't keep occurring over and over again. Different, you know, when randomness clumps, though, it's different each time. So therefore, those studies will not be reproducible. And in fact, that's what we see when psi researchers finally think that they have found a research protocol that shows a psi phenomenon, and then others try to reproduce the work, it turns out that they can't. So fluke positive studies can be chosen among many unpublished negative studies, kind of like optional starting and stopping, but for studies. If the effect is real, it should be consistently reproduced. The key flaw in the psi literature is this failure of reproducibility. Initial impressive results tend to diminish over time as tighter and tighter controls are introduced. This is a more general effect that we see in the literature. As the research gets more and more rigorous, effect sizes tend to shrink. The question is, do they shrink down to a small but real effect, or do they shrink down to nothing, to no effect? The Ganzfeld experiments are one example of this. This is a series of rigorous experiments looking at remote viewing. As the details of the studies came under scrutiny and follow-up studies were done with more and more rigor, the magnitude of the effect being measured shrank all the way down to essentially zero, there being no effect left. The precognition studies of Daryl Bem, to take a more recent example, are another example of this, of the so-called decline effect and the failure of reproducibility. Daryl Bem conducted a series of psychological experiments in which he concluded that subjects were able to see into the future. However, now multiple attempts at replication have shown that the results are completely negative, that this effect does not exist. One more example is spontaneous human combustion. You may have heard that scientists believe that people can spontaneously burst into flames and be completely consumed by the resulting fire. This is based almost entirely on unusual cases of death by fire, on anomalies that may defy easy or immediate explanation. the spontaneous human combustion phenomenon combines this anomaly hunting with the argument from ignorance. If we can't come up with an easy or obvious explanation for how someone died in a fiery death, then maybe they spontaneously burst into flames. Most of the cases, however, have an easily identifiable external source of flame that seems to be a consistent feature of spontaneous human combustion cases. Victims are often infirmed, so they could not readily move. Many of the times they're on sedating medication, they live alone, and they are smokers. Those all seem to imply a tendency for someone who is infirmed, unable to move, has a source of fire, may be sedated on medication, a setup for somebody setting themselves on fire, not to be discovered until after the fire has run its course. Researchers have explained even the really strange cases. Some researchers have discovered what we call the wick effect, that the body fat can act like the wax in a candle, with the clothing acting like a wick, although on the outside. This can create a situation where, especially in a closed room where oxygen levels will drop quickly from a fire, where the body will slowly be consumed by a smoldering fire that will not consume the surrounding building. It will cause some smoke damage to the building and some heat damage, but it will not. But the building that the person is in will not burst into flames itself. Therefore, firefighters will find a body almost completely turned to ash inside an unburned, although damaged, room. That phenomenon may seem strange, but it has now been thoroughly explained through scientific investigation. Believers, however, wildly speculate about what may cause spontaneous human combustion. You shouldn't, as a rule, attempt to invent an explanation for a phenomenon before you've documented that the phenomenon actually exists. In one book, Ablaze, author Larry Arnold invents a new primary particle that he calls the pyrotron. He is inventing new physics out of whole cloth without any evidence in order to provide a fanciful mechanism for spontaneous human combustion. He does this because there is no plausible physical or medical mechanism by which the body can heat up to the degree by itself that it can burst into flames. These are just a few examples of the thousands of pseudosciences out there, but they illustrate many of the common features. Believers think they are doing science, but they all have one common fatal flaw. They are insufficiently skeptical of their own claims. They are dazzled by what they think they have discovered, by the patterns they see, by the apparent confirmation. But they have failed to ask the key question, is it really true? And then set out to prove their own ideas false. Instead, they set out to prove their ideas correct. There are also some special categories of pseudoscience that are worth pointing out, such as grand conspiracy theories and denialism. I will tackle these specific types of pseudoscience in upcoming lectures.